14:17. Mr. Steele.
May it please the court, my name is Jonathan Steele, and I represent defendant appellant Milford Clark in this case. This case is about the government's unsupported request for reconsideration of a defendant's waiver of the right to counsel and the resulting violation of Milford Clark's Sixth Amendment rights. It is undisputed that Milford Clark knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waived his right to counsel and chose to proceed pro se at a pretrial hearing before Magistrate Judge Kenneth Foster. 28 U.S.C. 636 states that a magistrate's judge's ruling is only reviewable if it is contrary to law or clearly erroneous. Without alleging that that decision by Magistrate Judge Foster was contrary to the law, clearly erroneous, or otherwise deficient in any way, the government moved for reconsideration of the decision before the district judge. Put simply, the government wanted a second bite at the apple in front of a different judge at the expense of Mr. Clark's constitutional rights.
But was the judge really reviewing what the magistrate judge did, or just ensuring that the defendant was aware of what he faced pro se as a going to trial?
That's certainly a fair question. It was not couched as a request for reconsideration. It was simply a motion for a formal hearing. And the district judge did not engage in any analysis of Magistrate Judge Foster's ruling. And I think that is really where the problem lies. A valid waiver of the right to counsel is in effect until basically one of two things occurs. One, the defendant does something to does something to impliedly waive the right to counsel.
But didn't the magistrate judge, in going through the colloquy, even say to Mr. Clark that he could proceed pro se at this point, at this juncture, even suggesting that that was a preliminary determination?
He did say that. I don't think that that is necessarily a preliminary determination. I think that's actually consistent with the Sixth Amendment jurisprudence that a waiver of the right to counsel and that decision to pro se, to go pro se, is good until the defendant does something to put it at issue, or there's a substantial change in circumstances.
Was it an adequate Faretta inquiry before the magistrate judge?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why?
Magistrate Judge Foster went into the four areas that the Supreme Court and this circuit have said are necessary for a waiver to be knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. He went into the nature of the charges and quizzed Mr. Clark about the natures of the charges against him, the potential penalties that he faced upon conviction, his educational background. Mr. Clark told the court that he had graduated high school, he had attended some college courses, and had taken some legal courses in prison. And Magistrate Judge Foster then went on, and probably most importantly, specifically told Mr. Clark that he never recommends that a criminal defendant represent himself at trial. And he even says that he never recommends a lawyer do that. Mr. Clark undisputedly told the court that I understand the dangers of this going forward, but this is something I have to do, that there are reasons for it. And Mr. Clark,
did the magistrate judge review with Mr. Clark what would be required at trial if he represented himself? Which is really what the district court judge spent the majority of the time reviewing with him?
Certainly. Magistrate Judge Foster, I think, touched on the issues that Mr. Clark would face. But admittedly, the district court did go into a very, very detailed colloquy regarding the difficulties that he would face at trial. And I think that if this court were to decide that there was a basis for the district judge to take this issue up again for a second time, I think that there were three specific areas that the district judge went into that, according to Faretta, were improper. One being the district judge quizzed Mr. Clark about the science behind DNA, asking him, what do you know about DNA? What kind of research have you done on it? Second, it went into chain of custody issues. Tell me about what you know about chain of custody issues. And then thirdly, it went into the importance of cross-examining the government's DNA expert. that this DNA evidence was going to be quite overwhelming at trial, and that cross-examination was going to be key, and that trained lawyers are the best people to do that. And although not dispositive,
I don't understand why that flies in the face of Ferretta. I think the district court judge was just being cautious and making sure he understood that these areas would be critical or crucial to the trial. I don't understand why that's a problem.
Admittedly, this is a very it's a knife's edge, because the courts have said that, you know, that a criminal defendant's right to representation of counsel is a very valuable right, but at the same time, criminal defendants have the right to proceed pro se.
Well,
I think that excuse me.
Go ahead, finish your thought.
I think that what the court did here, maybe not by a huge manner, but she was quizzing Mr. Clark basically on his individual ability to try the case to verdict. And just like the Supreme Court said in Ferretta, where the circuit judge in California questioned the criminal defendant about his knowledge of the evidentiary code, that those were improper considerations on whether or not a criminal defendant can waive his right to counsel.
I don't know. What struck me about this case is I think that had the waiver that stood with the magistrate been all that took place in this case, I couldn't help but think that we'd be here today on why the district court didn't go further, because the magistrate said at this point. And so we'd be talking about that phrase, and that the magistrate judge's inquiry was limited to that hearing. It just strikes me that on this record, I would want to see more in terms of waiver for the defendant if it had just been what the magistrate said. What's your strongest argument that Clark did not voluntarily waive his right to proceed pro se?
I think that we've got two principal arguments. The first being that the hearing before Magistrate Judge Kenneth Foster was fully sufficient, and that there are only two circumstances where that valid waiver can be put back at issue before the court. One being the defendant does something to put it at issue, and two being a substantial change in circumstances. Mr. Clark certainly did not put it at issue. In the intervening time between Magistrate Judge Foster's hearing and the district judge's hearing, he was actively litigating his case in front of the court. He had filed motions in limine to suppress evidence, and he had also sent a letter to the court requesting additional research and writing materials. There was nothing that he did to put the issue before the court. And
would the fact that a trial was upcoming be a change in circumstances that would prompt that?
I don't think that there's any authority, certainly, that the government has cited or that I have seen, that merely the upcoming trial date would be a substantial change in circumstances that would warrant reconsideration of the issue. And so, you know, our first point being that you don't even really need to reach the second hearing, that the second hearing was improper, that there was nothing that Mr. Clark did to put the his self-representation at issue, and that the government never alleged that there was any deficiency in it. If you look at the government's motion for a formal hearing, they cite four areas of law that must be that a judge should go over with a criminal defendant to ensure that his waiver is voluntary. Magistrate Judge Foster went over each of those four areas. And all the government said was that we believe the trial judge should have an opportunity to examine Mr. Clark about that. Now, the logical extension of the government's argument, I think, is quite problematic. What you're going to run into is criminal defendants who have invoked and validly waived their right to counsel and chose to proceed pro se are potentially subject to continual hearings at the request of the government or the district court.
Well, this was just one time. This was just when he went before the district judge, and now the case was going to trial. The court didn't go over it again like at different aspects during the trial, did he?
No.
Are you sure you want to do this? You know, there's some issues with you being pro se. Let me make sure you really understand the implications. We're getting to a critical part in the trial now, so let me advise you further. It was just that one time only when it was clear it was going to trial.
That is correct. I think that it is critical that case law has said that a defendant's valid waiver of the right to counsel should be honored and should not be disturbed.
But what about the magistrate judge's comment, and this is where I started, at this point, at this juncture, didn't that leave open the possibility for the defendant to think, I can revisit this, or this will be revisited with me, that this is just temporary for now? I agree with what Judge Williams said, that if it hadn't gone through, you might be able to come back on an argument that the magistrate judge said it was just at this point. I didn't know that meant throughout trial.
I see I'm out of time, I think.
That's not going to get you out of the question.
No, 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 certainly
I know, you'd like to run and hide on it, but, I mean, it's a difficult, you're making a really difficult argument because we're just used to the flip side of this thing, that it would be, you know, a miscarriage of justice for the district court judge not to make sure it was clear what he was giving up. So,
certainly. I think that Magistrate Judge Foster's comments that at this juncture are entirely consistent with this circuit's authority, this jurisprudence, that a valid waiver of the right to counsel is not necessarily valid into perpetuity. There are things that can happen that require, you know, revisiting that particular subject. I think our point here is that none of those circumstances occurred here, other than, as you mentioned, a nearing of a trial date. But up until that point, Mr. Clark had done everything in his power to prosecute his case.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Steele.
Thank you.
Mr. DeBrada.
May it please the court, I'm a senior litigation counsel with the U.S. Attorney's Office. I was one of the trial counsel. We disagree fundamentally with several aspects of the interpretation of what occurred in front of the magistrate. And in line with several of Your Honor's questions, we do not think that what Judge Foster did would have been adequate to go all the way through the end of the case for several reasons. One is the comment at this juncture suggesting there could be another juncture. And more fundamentally, he said, you can change your mind. And he appointed standby counsel, who was sitting there. Now, what ends up happening is we have a hearing 33 days later, well before trial. In the intervening events, and we strongly disagree with this assertion, many, many things of significance had happened. First off, there was discovery. The prosecutors met with Mr. Clark in person, talked about the case, talked about what would be involved in the, because during that period he's being pro se. He indicates he has an alibi he would like to present involving an incarcerated person named Marvin Trent and his wife, Brenda Trent. Meanwhile, those two people had told the government that the alibi was false. Marvin Trent was incarcerated, so to get him to court, you would need a writ of habeas corpus ad testificandum, which Milford Clark had not filed in any timely basis. We filed a 404B notice. He filed a very, very inadequate objection to our 404B evidence, stating, in effect, since he hadn't robbed the Harvester Credit Union, the evidence should be excluded because the government was fishing without a license. Now, what Judge Barker did is do a hearing where everything she said was accurate, everything was done without objection by Mr. Clark. The hearing itself, when he was acting as his own counsel, he did not object to the holding of the hearing.
Mr. DeBrada, why did the government ask for that hearing?
Because we were really worried about the record. And I've also had a defendant pro se go pro se and want a lawyer on the day of trial. And we have bank robbery victims here, people who are traumatized. I wanted to have a solid record in front of both the magistrate and the district judge. In addition, and critically, the defense has cited a whole bunch of times 28 U.S.C. 636. That is for a district court to refer issues to the magistrate. That never happened. There was no referral. There is no report and recommendation. That rule does not apply. Judge Barker never gave the decision to the magistrate. End of story. We were worried about that, too. We do not think that asking a question could ever be reversible error. We don't think that providing accurate advice could be reversible error. We don't think that having a judge say the same thing but in greater detail and talk about new issues could be an error. Among the things that Her Honor talked about, the district court, were chain of custody, notice of alibi, jury selection, 404B evidence, the discussion of our 404B notice, his inadequate motion, the DNA cross-examination, limits on opening statement, strategy, and so forth, at the end of which she says essentially on page 51 of the record, so don't be your worst enemy here out of pride or arrogance. going on. Do you understand, sir? Yes, ma'am. Is there anything further you want to say today about these things? Yes, ma'am. Could I confer with Mr. Marsh for just 1 second? You may. Then I say, I need to make a record on something too, Your Honor, very briefly. Court says, all right. Discussion off the record. That's fatal. We don't know what Mr. Marsh discussed with Mr. Clark right there. What happens next is the defendant says, I've decided to let Mr. Marsh handle this, represent me. This is not a 2255. We don't know what they said. That matters. Now, if you want to look at the one thing they say is bad here, they say that Mr. Clark wanted cross-examination of the DNA evidence. At trial, he gave an explanation that explained why he had touched both the car and the bag. They didn't cross-examine the DNA expert because it would have been inconsistent with his theory of innocence. So that was clearly a trial decision. At page 19 of the reply brief, it ignores that reality. So put it all together, we think when Mr. Clark, during the hearing in front of Judge Barker, says, I want a lawyer, we had to give him one. So this issue's been waived. We'd rely on our brief for the rest of it, Your Honor.
Thank you. Your time has expired. You were appointed, Mr. Steele, weren't you?
Yes, ma'am.
And we thank you for your vigorous representation of your client. You just can't imagine how significant the work that you have done is, and that all counsel who take on these kinds of cases, and we're most appreciative. And, of course, counsel, we're appreciative of your work, and you always live up to the high standards of the U.S. Attorney's Office. With that, we'll take the case under advisement, and court will be in recess until it's next in session.